The subject for today has been covered before, not often. But I know it was covered in 2007 because I covered it. And they've often said that a speaker's best sermonette or sermon is given on the car on the way home after you've given it. Because you think of all the things that you should have said, could have said, would have said, but for some detail, or you slipped your mind, or you overlooked a paragraph. And so, a year and a half ago, I was asked to modify it and re-give it. And at that time, I came down with whooping cough. And so, I didn't have an opportunity to give it at that time, and for some reason, there weren't opportunities after that a year and a half ago. And so, I've had an opportunity to go over it and to revamp this. So those of you that have an inkling of this subject from 4 years ago, from 2007, there is some material that is supplemented. I'm going to talk today, if you need a title, and I like titles on mine, is Who is Our Advocate? And this is basically the sermon is about lawyers and about law. But of course, we have all heard plenty of lawyer jokes, and there's the standard ones that, because litigation touches every family in some way or another. It might be probating a deceased person's estate, it may be a car accident, a work injury, a family law circumstance, or perhaps a business complication. Usually the references to attorneys are negative. They're probably because most people have been on the painful receiving end of a bad deal involving an attorney. And of course, many lawyers make such easy and tempting targets. And as a result, you have a whole list of lawyer jokes that can roll off the tongue of some people because lawyers are simply not well thought of in many environments. What's the difference, for example, between a lawyer and a bucket of pond scum? Well, the answer would be, of course, the bucket. What's the difference between a lawyer and a catfish? Well, one is a slimy, bottom-dwelling scum sucker, and the other one is a fish. What is the difference between a lawyer and a trampoline? Well, you should take your socks off before you jump on a trampoline. For how many lawyers does it take to stop a moving bus? And the answer is, never enough. Or, what do honest lawyers and UFOs have in common? The answer is, you always hear about them, but you never see them. Or what do you have when a lawyer is buried up to his neck in sand? Well, the obvious answer is not enough sand. And then, of course, there's the heaven and hell lawyer joke. It's often said, of course, that lawyers have no conscience. They'll do anything for money. And so as the story goes, the devil was visiting a lawyer's office and made him an offer. The devil said, I can arrange some things for you. I'll increase your income fivefold. Your partners will love you. Your clients will respect you. You'll have 4 months of vacation each year, and you'll live to be 100 years old. All I require in return is your wife's soul and your children's souls, and their children's souls will rot in hell for eternity. And the lawyer thought for a moment and said, well, what's the catch? Well, now, of course, you may say, well, how many lawyer jokes are there? And, of course, the answer to that was there's only two. The rest of them are actually all true stories. And then there's the ultimate question. Why is it that 99% of all lawyers give the rest of them a bad name? Well, and we could go on, but you see, in our society and perhaps around the world, lawyers are often not well thought of. It's a negative connotation. So today, we're going to examine what the Bible says about lawyers. We're going to take a look at a few of the lawyers specifically mentioned in the Bible and how they've affected our lives. And we're going to summarize some lessons that the Bible has to teach us about our ultimate lawyer. Now, some of you may know that I do counsel people who are going through the distress of family court issues. Often a divorce includes child custody and child support or alimony, which is now called officially spousal maintenance. There may be a dividing of assets and liabilities. And sometimes there's criminal and drug issues that complicate matters. Over the last 15 years, I've worked with over 200 family court cases.
I think that in some respects I have more family court experience than many practicing lawyers do, certainly the ones I come across. As a result, I've had an occasion to see what happens to people in the court system, how the lawyers represent them, and how the respect for the law erodes if the law is not applied fairly and consistently. As you imagine, many, if not most people, are frustrated with their lawyers. By the time I get a phone call, just imagine that somebody is going down the St. Lawrence Seaway in a wooden barrel. The time when I get the phone call is when the barrel has just tipped over the edge of Niagara Falls. And I get a call that says, "Can you help me?" Now, of course, sometimes all I have to work with are the toothpicks at the bottom of the falls, but often because the predicaments are very, very difficult. Presently, I'm working with a mother who has three children, ages 6, 9, and 12. She hasn't worked outside the home in 13 years since she was pregnant with her first child. She homeschools her children. In the past year and a half, her soon-to-be ex-husband filed for divorce. During that time, she's gotten no spousal maintenance, and she's received minimal child support. She's tried in vain to get her own lawyer to help her, but she's made a terrible mistake. She paid her lawyer up front about $20,000 to represent her in this case. Well, once the lawyer had the money, he had no incentive to help the lady. Well, since things have gone downhill, I've helped the lady to arrange so that she could get food stamps and Medicaid for her children. You might remember that family in your prayers. The mother's a church member, and her estranged husband hates the Sabbath, hates the church, hates the church preteen and teen camps, hates the holy days that are outlined in the Bible, and he's diligently working to make her life difficult. I'm working with another divorce case. In this case, it's also with the wife. Usually I work with the fathers, but in this case is with the wife. She happens to be the dominant earner in the family. Her estranged husband is an alcoholic and decided he'd rather live on his own as long as he could get the courts to compel her to pay alimony to him. The children are grown, and unfortunately, because the woman has a substantial income and substantial assets, she's expected by the court to pay both attorneys and as well as expected to pay alimony. But remember, of course, he has chosen not to work for the last 8 years and has chosen to continue his disability, although not a recognized disability. In other words, it's not a Social Security disability. It's simply a choice he's made. I came across the scene this past month when I got the phone call when she realized that both attorneys were milking her. They were colluding to run up the lawyer's fees, and she was paying both sides. She was paying for them to talk to each other. It was supposed to be a collaborative, amicable divorce. The settlement had just never seemed to happen. Well, each attorney was getting about $1,000 a month for the last 6 months, so two attorneys, $2,000 a month, and they were talking and getting no place. So, since I've become involved recently, the entire matter should be wrapped up in a matter of a few weeks for less than $2,000, and it'll be all gone and be taken care of. But needless to say, the lady's not thrilled about the attorneys who are taking advantage of her. Just because she had substantial income and owned a dozen properties, she was a target. I could go on and on, but I think you get the idea. That some folks are less than thrilled about the legal representation provided to them by their lawyers. That their own lawyers have done things to them instead of for them. Of course, there are individual cases, these are, and not all situations are like this, but not every lawyer deliberately sets out to injure his or her client. Well, in order for there to be lawyers, there has to be a legal system. And this means a lawgiver, a set of laws, a judge with the authority to execute the judgment. In America, we have then three branches of government. We think of the legislative branch as the one that's the lawgiver, makes the laws. And then we have the executive branch of government. It carries out the wishes of the legislative branch, represented by the president. The legislative branch is the Congress, we have the president. And then we have the judicial branch, headed by the Supreme Court, which judges the application of the law. Well, but then we get to, well, really, what is law? We'll expand on that as we go through it, as we discuss lawyers. There's an entire hierarchy of law in the American legal system. In other words, some laws are higher than other ones. Laws aren't just made by the legislative branch. Our founding country's founding documents is called the Declaration of Independence, which separated the United States from Britain. However, when the United States separated from Great Britain, it kept all of what we call the common law, which is the court rulings, the way we normally do things. And so that was carried forward until America could establish its own laws. Well, common law is that common principles that set down since ancient times that have been carried forth generation after generation and governments regardless of who is in charge. And our present common law has its roots in Hebrew law and Roman law. Even now, judges will cite legal precedents that were established by court cases in ancient Rome. The bulk of the British system is built around common law, which is all the court decisions over all of the years. Examples of common law that you don't even need a law in the books for, because it can be prosecuted anyways, murder, kidnap, rape, arson, robbery, and assault, and so forth. Because on the face of it, these crimes are against the dignity of human civilization. Nobody needs to be told that these laws, that these are things are crimes. Everybody knows that. These examples of common law are quite different than the 2,000-page law established by the United States Congress to regulate the price of cabbage, for example. Very different in the hierarchy as to what's the more important law. Well, there's more than one type of law in the United States. Some have a higher ranking, so you have Declaration of Independence. Then you have common law that flowed forth from old British law and biblical principles. Then you've got modern common law, what the courts are deciding now. And once a court decides something, all the other courts under it are supposed to follow the same thing. And then there's the Constitution of the United States, and then laws passed by Congress, and laws passed by the legislature, and then you have something people don't often think of as law, but they sure do cuss it out a lot when they're down at City Hall or wherever else at some government agency, and that's called regulations. And that's where you have administrative or executive branch of government comes up with their laws that carry out the legislative laws. So they have all these little things, like your lawn has to be less than 10 inches high on grass, or the city will mow it, and it will put it on your taxes with the bill. And all of those things, or that may be a city ordinance, or it may be just an administrative one, where then the city comes in and says, well, we'll give you 10 days' notice, or we'll give you a week's notice, or whatever. And those are little administrative laws that come out. That's true at the federal, state, and local level. So you have all of these regulations, including local laws and taxing authorities by school districts and water districts. And then the court system also makes laws. They make their own. They're called rules. So you've got legislation for the executive, for the legislative branch, like Congress, and then you've got regulations by the executive branch, and then you've got the third group, and that's rules of the court. And the court makes its rules. It says you must submit everything on a certain kind of paper. It has to be double spaced. It must have a certain kind of margin. Must have a certain kind of header. Everything must be filed. You must do it on the proper time. You must do it so many days before you have a hearing, and all the rules that go forth. And then you have federal rules, you have state rules, and then you have local court rules. And you know, with all of these laws, and then frequently there's overlapping jurisdictions that can cause confusion. So you can see why it's necessary sometimes to have a lawyer to help guide people through that jungle of laws. That doesn't mean the lawyers know how, but it does mean you will pay them while they learn how. There are obligations of the government. We can see that in Deuteronomy 17, in verses 14 through 20. And here's where God explains, in Deuteronomy 17, in verses 14 through 20, there's the obligations of a king, or in our case, our national government, where God explains how the nation of Israel should set up a civil government. And the ancient Hebrew civil government was set up with a judge and then later with a king. And we can read about the expectations for a king to read and understand the law. So if you turn to Deuteronomy 17, you'll find, and it will list what is expected then of that leader. Today was not a good day to not remember my glasses. And so if we take a look in verse 14, it says that God will set a king over the people. And he tells what to do with the, what the king should not do. In verse 16, he shouldn't multiply horses to himself or cause them to go back to Egypt, or multiply wives, or multiply gold and silver to himself. In other words, politicians shouldn't enrich themselves at public expense. And not verse 18 in particular. And it shall be, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep the words of this law and these statutes and do them, that his heart be not lifted above his brethren, that he be turned aside not from the commandment to the right or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom and he and his children in the midst of Israel. In other words, he wasn't just to read it. He was to write out his own copy, put it into his mind so that he understood it well enough, because he was going to have to make decisions with regard to the law. At that time, the king was the head of all three branches of government. He made the laws, carried them out, and made the decisions afterwards. So you have that historical precedence on law. And then you have, today, of course, there are a number of types of law. And we have family law, and I've mentioned a little bit of that. There were the existence of marriage laws and legal relationships, such as in-laws, in the Bible, talks about them. And those laws are helpful for the ordinary operation of society. Because as we all know, estate and inheritance laws can get messy. So a set of laws is helpful to keep everything straight. And there's an example in Genesis 11. In 11 and verse 31. It's only one verse, but it, and in Genesis 11 and 31, it's talking about Abram, later to be called Abraham, and Sarah his wife. In Genesis 11, 31, and Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran's, his son's son, or his grandson, and Sarah, his daughter-in-law. In other words, by right to reason of law, in other words, that she has, and the term they use is the first degree of consanguinity, which is a big word for saying closely related, either by blood or by marriage, is closely related. And so that's the earliest reference I could find to in-laws in the Bible. Another example is the entire book of Ruth. We don't have to turn there, but I'll just refer to the entire book as an example of inheritance law and how it affected the legal and biological ancestry of Jesus Christ, and then, by example, how we are all eligible to inherit the promises of the kingdom of God, the promises that were made to Abraham. Of course, the book of Ruth is another topic for another time, and traditionally it's read during the Feast of Pentecost. Perhaps next year we'll hear more about the book of Ruth. With the inheritance laws, there's a law of primogeniture where the eldest child inherits the whole thing, or a double portion of at least of the estate. I know the patriarch of the Martens clan came from Germany, well, actually it was West Prussia at the time, and he was married three times and had three sons. He was married his first time and had a son, and his wife died. And he remarried and had a second son, and his second wife died. Many years had passed. He remarried a third time and had a third son, and then he died. His son was 2 years old, leaving presumably a younger wife. The eldest, of course, inherited the property in Germany, and that left two sons to inherit nothing. So the second son went to Brazil, and the third son went to the United States. So there's three clans now of Martins, once in Germany and one in Brazil, and as well as the United States side. And there's some letter exchanging that has gone on over the years. Then that's family law. Then there's criminal law. We're all familiar with the kinds of criminal law against stealing, murder, perjury, false witness, kidnapping, and so forth. And then one of our favorites, which is tax law. Taxes have been around a long time. In Genesis 47, verse 26, and some people try to use this to throw this in the face of Christians, that the government is authorized to pretty much take anything they want from you. In Genesis 47, verse 26, and this is the time when the Israelites were in Egypt, and Joseph was made just under Pharaoh. And you'll notice Joseph made a law over the land of Egypt. verse 47, or chapter 47, verse 26, that Pharaoh should have a fifth part, or 20% tax, except the land of the priests, which became not Pharaoh's. In other words, it was a tax laid on him. But you'll note for the record that this was a temporary tax. It was only during the good years. It wasn't during the bad years. It was only for a limited period of time, and that time of plenty. There's another famous passage in the Bible regarding taxes. It's a quotation of Christ found in Matthew 27. I'm not going to turn there. From Matthew 22 and verses 17 and then 19 and 21. And you'll recall it quickly. It's render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. And he's referring there to taxation. The word lawyer is an English word, as compared to the word attorney, which is a French word. The word advocate is the German word for lawyer. Now, turn to Webster's New 20th Century Dictionary. It defines lawyer this way: one who's been trained in the law, especially one whose profession is advising others in the matters of law or representing them in lawsuits. So advising people and then speaking for them in a legal situation. The definition then of attorney is further described. Remember, one was an English definition, now here's the French. Is further described as one who is legally appoints another to act for him. An attorney is either public or private. A private attorney is a person appointed by another. An example of that would be if you have the power of attorney for someone else, you can act on their behalf. That would be the power of attorney or a private attorney, where you can sign for them, you can conduct business, whether they're in a hospital or in a nursing home or a hospice, or maybe they're going on a trip. And as I had to do one year, and I had sold a house, but I wasn't going to be there for the closing, I gave someone else the power of attorney to close the house, sign the documents, close it all out, and be so kind as to send me the proceeds. Hopefully they wouldn't make off and run to Mexico with them. But they could have done that if they wanted to, because they had full authority to do it. And then there's a public attorney, in the French definition, that where a public attorney is an officer of the court that can prosecute or defend actions in court. So that's what most people think of when they think of the term lawyer, is somebody who does something in court. Now, the definition of advocate, which is Old English or German, is one who pleads the cause of another in a court of law, or who's a counsel or counselor, a person who defends, vindicates, or espouses a cause by argument, one who is friendly to an upholder or a defender. And I want to hang on to this particular definition, because we're going to see how that applies as we go later into the message, the definition of advocate in Old English or German, and why it was chosen that way when they made the King James Bible. Sometimes you'll hear a lawyer referred to as a counselor. The definition of counsel or counselor is one who gives legal advice, or a legal advisor or a lawyer, especially one who conducts cases in court. So a counselor doesn't have to be a lawyer, but often is. So lawyers go by many titles: lawyer, solicitor, barrister, attorney, advocate, counsel, counselor, prosecutor, or defender. Well, how long have lawyers been around? Let's turn to the first mention of a lawyer in the Bible. The first one mentioned is a counselor counseling his client on the law before the court of the living God. Let's turn to Genesis 3:1. In Genesis 3:1. And of course, this is the story at the time when there were only two people on earth, and that was Adam and Eve. In Genesis 3:1, now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Yes, God has said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden." So far, he's correct. And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the tree of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God says, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die," meaning the tree of life. "And the serpent said to the woman, you shall not surely die." Well, let's examine this last statement for just a moment. The serpent was counseling the woman, saying, "You shall not surely die." Let's turn to 1 John in chapter 3 and verse 4. We only need part of the verse because it encapsulates clearly what we need. In 1 John in chapter 3 and verse 4, Sin is the transgression of the law. 1 John 3:4, sin is the transgression of the law. Many of us probably have that committed to memory. Then we can flip over to Romans 6:23. That first of all, we learn sin is a transgression of the law. Second, then in Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death. And that's reinforced. The wages of sin is death. So a person sins, the wages is death. It's earned. So in other words, just because you earn it doesn't always mean you get it. But in Ezekiel 18:20, it says very clearly, in Ezekiel 18:20, the soul of the person that sins, it shall die. So in other words, there's a standard, there's the law. Sin is a transgression of the law. The wages, what is earned from that, is death. And then that will actually happen. It will actually be carried out. There's an entire sequence. So in other words, this particular lawyer, and we'll call him a lawyer because he was counseling the woman Eve about the law, the serpent. The lawyer serpent counseled the woman Eve exactly opposite of the truth. He told her she would not die if she disobeyed God. The lawyer gave her bad advice. But let's continue on in verse 5 and 6. For God does know that in the day you eat thereof, your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof, and did eat, and gave unto her also her husband with her, and he did eat. So here was the lawyer, a serpent, the legal counselor, who was wrongly advising someone about the law, saying, the law didn't really mean what it plainly said. And the willing clients, in this case Adam and Eve, took the lawyer's bad advice and suffered the consequences. By the way, and that's still true today. If you take a lawyer's bad advice, you are the one who will suffer the bad consequences. There are three kinds of lawyers. We've talked about a number of different kinds. I want to separate them out a little differently. First of all, there's criminal prosecutors. In our local county government, there's an elected person, a person called the county prosecutor. In some areas, there's also a city attorney who is the prosecutor. So, and the prosecutor is the one who brings formal charges in court against an accused person. It's the city or county prosecutor who makes the claims of wrongdoing against the accused, and then a defending attorney must stand up and speak for the accused person. In America, each state has an attorney general, the chief lawyer of the state, and his staff prosecute cases in state courts. The federal government has an attorney general whose staff attorneys prosecute cases in federal courts. So there's layers of attorneys who are prosecutors. It's their job to make accusations. Some of the oldest biblical references to lawyers are the mention of accusers. A formal accusation was then brought of somebody was then brought before a king, so the king could make a judgment or a decision. We already read in Deuteronomy 17 about the necessity of the king knowing the law so that he was prepared to make judgments. And we're familiar with the story of the prophet Daniel in the book of Daniel. Well, Daniel was a Jewish prince, and he was a prophet and a government administrator, and he was formally accused before the king. Whereupon Daniel was then condemned under the law at that time, under the king's law, and thrown into the lion's den. Of course, we recall how that circumstance came out, where the laws of God trumped the laws made up by man. And then there's a case recorded in the book of Esther, where her cousin or uncle, however you read the translation, where Mordecai was accused by Haman. He was a formal accuser. Haman was a high government official accused by Haman. And, of course, that did not work out well for Haman. But then the Bible does refer to a number of prosecutors. There's also, we also mentioned civil lawyers, those who bring private lawsuits. So we've talked about government prosecutors bringing charges before the government and before the king. And then there are lawyers who bring private lawsuits on behalf of someone who feels only been wrong. And we hear about this all the time. So-and-so sued so-and-so. And because they want the power of the state to kind of fix this big problem. It may be a lawsuit to recover property, to obtain a money judgment for an injury or an accident, to request the court to order a particular outcome. And it could be anything. Inheritance, custody, restraining order, preventing somebody from doing something. Just this week, what great timing, I received notice, I think it was Thursday, that the state of Arkansas is going to sue us to exercise eminent domain so they can take away some of our property. They claim they want our property to build a bridge. What I discovered they really want it is to build a boat landing and such on the property. And the bridge our building is actually across from the other side of the other one. But because they think they have all the power in the world, they think they can do that. We shall see. But there are lawyers around us who are accusers in our temporal world. In other words, they're everywhere. They will accuse, they will try something. But in our spiritual world, who's the chief accuser? Who is it that continually puts us in our individual lives on trial? Who is it that constantly accuses or prosecutes us? Let's turn to Revelation 12 and verse 10. In Revelation 12 and verse 10, we're going to look up who is our chief accuser. In Revelation 12 and verse 10, "And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now is come salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accuses them before our God day and night." The them in this case means they're talking about the brethren. The accuser of the brethren is cast down. In other words, there's an accuser of the church members that were cast down. So at that point, then the kingdom of God, salvation comes. Well, it says the accuser was cast down to earth, but who just was it that was cast down? Let's stay in that same chapter, and then through chapter 12 of Revelation, back up a few verses into verse 7. "And there was a war in heaven, and Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. And the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven." And verse 9, "And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world, was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with it." So Satan and his demons are the accusers of the brethren. Let's take a look at the accuser of the brethren in action in the book of Job. In the book of Job, in chapter 1, in verse 6. In Job, chapter 1, and verse 6. So here's the accuser in action. And here's an example that's recorded to help us to remember. In verse 6, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Eternal said to Satan, From where do you come? And Satan answered to the Eternal and said, From going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it." Verse 8. "And the Eternal said to Satan, Have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that fears God and eschews evil. And Satan answered the Eternal and said, Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him and about his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. Verse 11, But put forth your hand now, touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." In other words, Satan, the accuser, challenged God over the faithfulness of Job. Well, but not all lawyers are accusers. Remember the definition of lawyers, attorneys, advocates, and counselors, that they are persons who often speak for others. The patriarch Abraham acted as a lawyer. He was an advocate when he bargained with God in an attempt to save Sodom from destruction. Of course, you realize that, remember at that time, his nephew Lot and Lot's family were living in Sodom, and God said that he was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Let's turn to Genesis 18. We'll start at verse 20 in Genesis 18. In verse 20. "And the Eternal said, Because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done according to the cry of it which has come to me, and if not, I will know." He's going to go and find out if the sin, in other words, it was He was going to say, is the sin as bad as what it appears to be? Verse 22, and the men turned their faces and went toward Sodom, but Abraham stood yet before the Eternal. In other words, those were the men that had visited, actually the angels that had visited Abraham, if we'd gone back previous in the chapter. And now imagine the nerve of Abraham. Imagine the relationship you would have to be with God for this conversation to occur. It says, Abraham stood yet before the Eternal. And so Abraham now proceeds to bargain with God, to advocate for people who might be righteous in Sodom. And verse 23, and Abraham drew near and said, now notice, he drew near. How do you draw near to God? Prayer? Fasting? Study? Abraham drew near and said, will you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Peradventure, which is an old English word for if, in other words, or if under the circumstances, peradventure there be 50 righteous within the city. Will you destroy and not spare the place for 50 righteous that are in? Far be it from you to do after this manner, to slay the righteous from the wicked, and the righteous should be as the wicked, in other words, suffer the same fate. That be far from you. Shall not the judge of all earth do right? In other words, you would think that Abraham was pretty bold here, saying, you know, speaking to the Creator, saying, surely you wouldn't do this. And verse 26, the Eternal says, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous in the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes. And Abraham answered and said, and then he went one step further in verse 27, and behold, now I've taken upon me to speak to the Eternal, I, which am but dust and ashes. In other words, I am nothing. He understood his position. He came from the earth. He was just, God made him of the dust of the earth, and he understood that. But he was bold enough to come before the Creator in verse 28 and say, peradventure there should lack but 5 of the 50 righteous. Will you destroy the city for the lack of 5? And God said, if I find there 45, I will not destroy it. And we go through this in the next verses 29 and 30. He's bold enough to ask about 40. And then he jumps at his tad when he goes down to verses 30 and 31. He says, well, hey, what about, he's no longer going by 5s. He goes, what about 30? You know, he's going by 10s. And God says, okay, for 30. And then what about 20 in verse 31 and 32? And finally gets down to verse 32 and says, oh, let the Lord not be angry, and I will speak yet this once. In other words, the last time, peradventure 10 shall be found there. And God said, I will not destroy it for 10's sake. The Eternal went his way, and as soon as he had left, communing with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Abraham was an advocate. He spoke up. He didn't live in Sodom. He did not have a financial interest in Sodom. He had a nephew there, and his nephew's family, but he didn't personally. He was intervening for somebody else. He was bargaining with God, and I don't know that I would have the courage to do that. But of course, it did say he was communing with God, and he did draw close to God, and he was a man of faith. It's not the only example in the Bible where someone spoke up and advocated for someone else. We have that example about Moses advocated before God for the entire nation of Israel. And that's in Exodus 32. And starting in verse 7, and the Eternal said to Moses, Exodus 32 and verse 7, the Lord Eternal said to Moses, go and get you down, for your people which you brought out of Egypt have corrupted themselves. And he goes on to say that he is going to do them in and start over with Moses. Verse 10, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may wax hot against them, the Israelites, that I may consume them, and they will, and make of you, meaning you, Moses, a great nation. In other words, start over, just like he started over with Noah, to start over with Moses. And what did Moses do in verse 11? And Moses besought the Eternal his God and said, why does your wrath wax hot against the people which you brought forth out of the land of Egypt with great power and mighty hand? Wherefore should the Egyptians speak and say, for mischief did he bring them out to slay them in the mountains and consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your wrath and change this opinion against the people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, or Jacob, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your seed, and so forth. So Moses pleaded the cause and the case of the nation of Israel. In other words, he took an active part for those people because he was going to be okay. He was going to be fine, but he put himself out to speak for others. We've mentioned before the types of lawyers. In England, of course, the lawyer is one who advises about the law and prepares legal documents. He could probably be an introvert because he never actually has to go to court. He's called a solicitor or a lawyer. And then the barrister is one who actually stands up and argues the cases in court. Under French, of course, we talked about a private attorney and a public attorney. Under German law, there's an advocat, who is a lawyer that advises about the law and prepares his documents, and an Anwalt, a lawyer who argues the cases in court. Often they're all merged together into one person called an attorney or an advocate. And so, just as there's various kinds of lawyers today in the world, there were various kinds of lawyers in Jesus' time when he was walking on the earth during his 30 years. There were Pharisees that were adherents to the strict form of the law based on Mosaic law, which included law handed down by oral tradition. In other words, you had written law, and then you had what did the priests say about it. In other words, there was an oral tradition. Then there were Sadducees, adherents to the written law only. They didn't believe in following any oral traditions, as did the law of the more strict Pharisees. It was a few years ago, in fact, 4 years ago, there was a Bible study in Branson about the Apostle Paul. Paul, then named Saul, was a Pharisee. He was a strict keeper of the law, not just of the written law, but of the oral law, as strict as you could possibly be. And by all indications, Saul was a lawyer and even a prosecutor in his day. You can look at Acts 22, verses 3 and 4. And he calls attention to his credentials. In Acts 22 and verses 3 and 4. I am verily a man, which am a Jew, born of Tarsus in the city of Cilicia, yet brought up in the city at the feet of Gamaliel, and taught according to the perfect manner of the law of the fathers, and was zealous toward God, as you are all today. And I persecuted this way unto the death, binding and delivering unto prisons both men and women. Now Paul, then known as Saul, had the authority to formally accuse church members and then follow through and see to it they were punished, whether it's prison or putting them to death, as happened to Stephen. Now, you had to have the authority to do that, and of course, that's implied in this, studying at the feet of a famous law teacher, Gamaliel. Paul spoke both Greek and Hebrew. He was studied in the law, and as a prosecutor then, he wielded that authority. But when Paul became a Christian, he gave up that legal profession and returned to his trade of tent maker, a trade that he had learned in his youth. However, Paul retained his knowledge of the law, and he was able to use that knowledge in his own defense as well as to spread the gospel. We read that in Acts 22. In Acts 22, starting in verse 24, the chief captain commanded him, meaning Paul, be brought into the castle and bade that he, meaning Paul, should be examined by scourging. In other words, if we whip them long enough, they'll confess to whatever we want them to confess to, that they might know wherefore they cried so against him. In other words, he should confess. Verse 25, and they bound him with thongs. Paul said to the centurion that stood by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and uncondemned? When the centurion heard that, verse 26, he went and told the chief captain, saying, take heed for what you do, for this man is a Roman. Now, I would like to call attention to the United States Constitution as a Bill of Rights. And those Bill of Rights specify what the government cannot do. It's really, the rights are reserved to people. So what the government cannot do is to infringe upon those rights. And in that time, at Paul's time, he was a Roman citizen. He similarly had the rights of a Roman citizen, the Bill of Rights, if you will.
And so he was saying, are you sure you want to do this to a Roman citizen? With the explanation, you're going to be in a whole lot of trouble for this. And so verse 27, the chief captain, this is the one now in verse 24 that told him that he should be scourged, or in other words, whipped or flailed. And the chief captain came and said to him, tell me, are you a Roman? Paul, then he said, yes. Verse 28, and the chief captain answered, with a great sum, I obtained this freedom, meaning I was able to become a Roman citizen. And Paul said, I was reborn. He didn't have to buy his citizenship. He had the rights by birth. Verse 29, then straightway they departed from him that they should have examined him. In other words, they knew they made a mistake. They shouldn't have done it. And the chief captain was afraid after he knew that he, Paul, was a Roman, and because he had bound him. It was illegal to scourge a Roman citizen who had not been yet condemned by a Roman court. And Paul was calling this to her attention. Later on, Paul continued then, in his knowledge of the law, to secure his freedom from additional punishment, which the Jews wanted to administer. And that's in Acts 25 and verse 9. And thereafter, Acts 25 and verse 9, about Paul answering to the Jews. In verse 9 it says, but Festus, willing to do a Jew a pleasure, answered Paul and says, will you go up to Jerusalem and be judged of those things before me? Of course, Paul was not really excited about being judged by the Jews, because he knew that they would want to kill him. He knew what he was like before he became converted. He did not want to be judged. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as they very well know. Verse 11, for if I be an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die, but if there be none of these things whereof they accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. Because why? I appeal to Caesar. In other words, he's appealing to a higher court, to Rome. Verse 12, then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, said, have you appealed to Caesar? Then to Caesar you shall go. You know, I saw this in court one time, where the man stood before the judge. And the man stood there and pointed out 28 things of the way that the judge had broken the law. Stood before the judge. And it was all a matter of record. And the court reporter was typing it all down. The courtroom was full. And he went through and step by step said the law and how the judge broke the law in this case. And the law. And he stood before the judge. And the judge remained silent. And at the end of the discourse, the judge did something that I've not seen before or since. The judge took up the file, looked at it, put it down, and said that he didn't think he had done anything wrong, but if the person before him felt uncomfortable with him as a judge, he was withdrawing himself from the case, left all of the documents where they were, and walked out of the courtroom. And left it for somebody, some other judge, to cover the case. This is similar to what happened here when Paul appealed or was before Festus and the council. And what did the council say? You appeal to Rome? Off to Rome you go! Because Paul understood the process. Okay. And, of course, that's verified in verse 16. It's not the matter of Romans to deliver any man to die before that which he is accused, before the accusers face to face, which is also, by the way, now in American law, it's in the Amendment 6 in the Bill of Rights, and have a license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. So Paul understood as a Roman citizen that he had those rights and privileges. He understood that because he was well-learned in the law. Also, Paul understood that there was a time and a place for a lawyer to act on his behalf. You look in Titus 3, in verse 13, Paul wrote in this epistle to Titus, and it's a short verse, in verse 13, Titus 3, 13, he was asking in his letter, bring Zenas the lawyer and Apollos on their journey diligently, that nothing be wanting to them. In other words, he needed a lawyer for his circumstances. Because he understood what needed to be done. But if you're in prison, you can't go out and go do those things. So he wanted
his lawyer to come. I have a relative who likes to quote scripture. He's not a Christian. He's at best an agnostic, frequently claims to be an atheist, but he's far too learned about the Bible and too nervous about what could be coming thereafter, so he kind of hedging his bets a little bit to be an agnostic. But he has a favorite Bible verse, and it's Luke 11:46. And he can quote it very well, Luke 11:46. And I'm sure some of you could probably quote it as well as soon as you hear it. In Luke 11:46, and Christ said, "Woe unto you also, you lawyers, for you lave men with burdens grievous to be borne, and you yourselves touch not the burdens with one of your fingers." In other words, they were making life difficult for others, but they didn't have to suffer the consequences. Of course, we know in modern times many lawyers become politicians, politicians go to Congress, and then they make laws that affect the rest of us, but then those politicians, largely lawyers, exempt themselves from the very laws that they would have us to follow. In other words, harsh consequences for other people, but no consequences for themselves. This is all Christ explained that this would happen. And I'm not going to turn there, but I will reference Matthew 11:39. But Christ said that the lawyers make the burdens heavy, but in Matthew 11:30, "My yoke is easy and my burden is light." Unlike the lawyers that he's referring to, Christ said, "My yoke is easy, my burden is light." In other words, it's not the same as these other lawyers, man's lawyers, who make life difficult for you. In Galatians 6:2, I'm not going to turn there, but I will reference it because I'm sure you're familiar with it. In Galatians 6:2, "Bear you one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ." In other words, those burdens, many hands make for a light burden, and when we can share our burdens with each other, when we can help each other, when we can advocate for each other, we can fulfill the law of Christ, which is the law of love. We can bear other people's burdens. This is the approach that Christ was taking. And not, as the lawyers would, burdening other people down with grievous burdens. Christ was repeatedly questioned by lawyers in Matthew 22 and verse 35. And I'm just going to refer, it's just a notation. "Then one of them, which was a lawyer, asked him a question, tempting him." In other words, you could see the attitude. In other words, asking a question, tempting Christ, trying to trip him up, get him to say something. And you see that often on the witness stand, where the lawyer will ask a question such as to the witness, "Have you stopped beating your wife yet?" Now, if the witness answers yes, that means he used to beat his wife, but he's now stopped. If the witness answers no, that means he used to beat his wife and he hasn't stopped, so he's continuing on. And either way, he answers yes or no, he's guilty. So in other words, that's a leading type of question, and Christ was on the receiving end of those kinds of questions. Luke 10:25 has the same explanation of that same instance. "And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tempted him, saying," in other words, prodding, poking, trying to trip him up. And Luke 7:30, "And the Pharisees and lawyers rejected the counsel of God against themselves." In other words, it didn't apply to me. It applies to you, rejecting the counsel of God against them. In other words, what was it back in Luke 11:46? It applies to other people. They'll apply the burdens to others, but not to themselves. And in the verse before that, before 11:46, in verse 11:45, one of the lawyers who was taking exception to what Christ says, said, "And then answered one of the lawyers and said to him, Master, when you say this, you approach us also." In other words, hey, you're talking about us here. How uncomfortable that was. And in Luke 11:52, "Woe unto you lawyers, for you've taken away the key of knowledge and entered not in yourselves, that they that then were entering, that you hindered." In other words, stopping other people from making the progress that they would otherwise have made. And Christ was, tempted, well, you can look in Luke 14:3 about the lawyer saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" They're always trying to trip him up. Actually, when you stop and think about it,
And here it's really quite silly. You have lawyers arguing with the lawgiver over the intent and application of the law. Yet the law lawyers in Christ's day were doing exactly that. Well, we've seen lawyers and advocates, counselors, attorneys can advise either good or evil. And the lawyers argue cases before a judge. And that a legal system requires law and a lawgiver and a judge and advocates. But who's our advocate before the throne of God, the Father? Who's our ultimate judge? I'd like you to turn to 1 John 2 in verse 1. As the most critical verse I want to bring today, 1 John 2 in verse 1. In 1 John 2, 1, my little children, these things I write to you that you sin not. And if any man sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. Verse 2, and he is the propitiation for our sins, and not for ours only, but also for the sins of the whole world. Verse 3, and hereby do we know that we know him if we keep his commandments. Now, if you take a look at the word advocate, we have an advocate with the Father. In the Latin Vulgate, it's advocatum or advocatum. In the Greek, it's parakletos. It's the only time that that particular Greek word is translated that way, as an advocate with the Father. In other words, it's somebody who's diligently advocating, who's standing up, saying for something to somebody else. Jesus Christ is not only acting as our lawyer, he's willing to take the punishment that we deserve and then take that and apply the punishment to himself. Well, let's give that a thought for a moment. Many of us go to a tax preparer. The tax preparer assists us in filing out the appropriate tax documents. We send in a check by April 15th to pay our taxes. How many tax preparers do you know who volunteer to pay your taxes for you? Or how many tax preparers do you know who will go to prison for you for a fraudulent tax filing? Here we have a lawyer in Jesus Christ, an advocate, who is not only willing to argue our case for us in front of God the Father, but he's willing to take the punishment that we deserve upon himself. Tell me, is there any lawyer on earth who is willing to say, look, don't worry, if the judge rules against you in this case, I'll do the prison time for you. Or if the death penalty is involved, say, oh, don't worry, I'll go to the gallows or the electric chair instead of you. There's something else that Jesus Christ, the lawyer, does for us. In Hebrews 7, verse 25. Wherefore he's able to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by him, seeing that he ever lives to make intercession for them. I want to just describe this concept of intercession for just a moment. In legal terms, when there's a legal case that involves two parties, we usually think of them as a plaintiff, who's the accusing party, and the defendant, who's the other party, who's trying to, says the plaintiff is wrong or he doesn't want to suffer the punishment or whatever. But there's a third party that can be intervene in a case and become an official party to the lawsuit. This third party is called an intervener, and they file a petition with the court and says, hey, I'm neither the plaintiff or the defendant, but I have an interest in this case. I want to be the intervener. And so the intervener can inject himself into a case with all of the rights and privileges associated with being an official party in the lawsuit, just as if he were a plaintiff or a defendant. What we've learned from this verse, in other words, that Christ is quite willing to intercede in this from Hebrews 7:25, that Christ is the willing intervener in our case before God the Father. It's because in our earthly temporal world, that intervener can then file the intercessory papers with the court and ask for special treatment for the defendant. In the Supreme Court cases, there is something similar to it, not exactly, but it's not uncommon for someone to file what they call a friend of the court brief, to be filed on half of one side or the other. In each of our individual cases, as we approach God the Father, we have an intervener or an intercessor in Jesus Christ who's willing to step forward on our behalf and argue our case for us, and then willing to take the punishment that we deserve to ourselves. In Romans 8:31,
In Romans 8:31, what shall we say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? In other words, if we have such an intervener and we have the relationship that God, that Abraham had with God, communing with God, was close to him, we have that intervening for us, who could possibly be against us? Can Satan prevail against us? I think not. I want to close with a poem written in 2003 by Robert Barnes that speaks to the issue, and I was quite surprised to find this poem, but it's entitled, Jesus is My Lawyer. I'm going to change one or two words to make it fit our circumstance. Earth came to the end. The first thing I remember was sitting upon a seat. After waiting and waiting, the chamber opened, and what did my two eyes meet? As I looked around, I saw a man in a tie. He was a villainous-looking gent. He resembled every other lawyer I knew, with horns and a tail and scent. To my left was my attorney, a kind and gentle man, so familiar to me, I knew him. Yet his name I could not understand. The doors flew open, there appeared the judge, appearing in full command. His presence was awesome as he crossed the room. He sat and said, "Let's begin." The prosecutor arose. "I am the accuser. Why is this man not in hell? My lies, my cheats, and all of my sins, not one did he fail to tell. Embarrassed, angry, hurt, and ashamed, my chances of winning were not looking swell. My defense against Satan by my quiet attorney seemed utterly doomed to fail. Satan finished with fury. This man comes with me." And he sat with a smirk and a smile. And I knew it was all over. My attorney did too. We were both just staring at dirt. But then my attorney stood up and he asked the judge, "May I approach the chair?" Over much strong objection, he stood and he walked with poise and no obvious flair. Everything seemed to change, and then I understood. My attorney was no man like me. He was God the Son approaching the Father, and the devil was soon to flee. He stopped by the bench and said with a smile, "Father, the devil is right. This man is a jerk, a fiend, and a liar, and the wages of sin are not light. But my death on the cross is more than enough to cover the sins of his life. All his days I continue to plead. I've been part of his case. But there is nothing else to do or to say, for I was condemned in his place." The judge thought for a moment, had lifted his hand and slammed the gavel down. "This man is free. His debt has been paid, and from Satan I'll not hear a sound." The Lord led me away, and the doors opened wide, revealing my kingdom's home. And I owe it all to the oddest of all that I've ever seen or heard, a lawyer who worked without a fee and a sinner with a sentence interred.